This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. Here it is, week four of broadcasting from my closet. And it's almost enough to get a sports reporter down. Luckily, I found a little pick-me-up this week, a joyful tribute in the face of so much bad news. Maybe you saw it too. That's a recent Instagram Live from my favorite sports power couple, three-time WNBA champion and four-time Olympic gold medalist Sue Bird, and two-time Women's World Cup champion and Sports Illustrated's 2019 Sportsperson of the Year, Megan Rapinoe. And I can't believe I'm saying this, but Megan and Sue, welcome to Only a Game.
Hi, thanks for having us.
So, like the rest of us, you're staying at home right now. How you holding up?
We're pretty good. So far, so good. Yeah. We've been saying, I mean, we're really fortunate. You know, we have a place to shelter in place and our jobs have been sort of postponed, but eventually we'll get those back and, you know, we're able to be safe and just kind of hole up for a while.
I like to picture that the two of you, whenever it gets really stressful, you just break into song. That's what I like to hold in my heart.
That was actually pretty just impromptu and random, to be honest.
The first one.
Which actually makes it even better. Mm-hmm. Totally not planned.
And if talking to me one-on-one, would you become somebody else?
So there's actually a serious reason I wanted you to come on the show, and that story starts with what was supposed to be a big summer in women's sports. Sue, let's start with basketball. People are still talking about last year's WNBA final.
Tolliver cuts through and scoops it in!
The league has a new commissioner, a new labor deal, more games scheduled for TV. How did you feel about the momentum heading into the 2020 season?
Well, we had it. That's for sure. You know, all the things you just listed, I think we were headed in a direction that we really hadn't been in a while, maybe ever, to be honest, excluding like the first couple years of the league. It felt like we had turned a corner. We were about ready to explode. And then this obviously happens. So for a lot of reasons, it's a big bummer for women's basketball. Another one is the NCAA tournament. You know, there was a lot of excitement in women's college basketball even, and that ultimately will impact the WNBA because all of those seniors were going to come into our league. Obviously, basketball is probably like the last on the list in terms of like life, but just in this one little conversation we're having, it's really unfortunate for women's basketball. Not to say that we can't pick up that momentum whenever we can, but it is a downer.
So, Megan, as everyone knows, you're coming off a big World Cup win.
Rapinoe sends it in low. Go, U.S.!
And the Women's Pro Soccer League here in the U.S., the NWSL, has also been gaining in attendance, attention, and advertising dollars. This year's season opener between your OL Reign and the Washington Spirit was scheduled to be the league's first live national broadcast. It really feels like this is all being put on hold at the worst possible time.
Yeah, it's not great timing. coming off a great year, obviously the World Cup. But I think we also get momentum from other sports as well. Obviously, the WNBA had their contract negotiations and, you know, what was a really big win, not just for them, but for other women's sports as well. And sort of course, we would love to just kind of roll right into it. But this will just demand our creativity when we get back out there.
Well, as all this was sort of happening, as the Olympics were postponed and seasons were delayed, I've got to think it had to be somewhat of a mixed bag for both of you. I mean, on the one hand, it's the only decision that could possibly be made for everyone's safety. On the other hand, it's got to be kind of scary to be told, as so many people are right now, you just can't do your job.
Yeah, I think we actually might have a little bit of a unique standpoint in that my dad has actually been like monitoring. He's a doctor, which kind of gives him a little bit of street cred, but like, I'm not joking. I can remember the day because he was visiting me in Seattle. It was like February 23rd. And he was like, I wouldn't be surprised if the Olympics are canceled. And I was like, what?
Yeah,
get out of here.
We're like,
no.
Extreme.
But then like, again, he was visiting for a couple of days. So like in those couple of days, we had more and more conversations. And I remember I even had just in those couple of days had gotten to a point where I was like, no, dad, if anything, they would go fanless. like they would figure out a way. And I was like relaying all this to Megan. Mm-hmm. Very quickly, I was in a mental space of like, oh my God, this might get canceled. So truth be told, when it finally came out that it was being postponed a year, was music to our ears. Kind of like, woof, at least it's happening.
Yeah, it was kind of a weird time too. The further it got along without canceling, it put a lot of stress on athletes. Most of the athletes haven't qualified yet. So to, you know, find pools to swim in, or I don't know, judo players, like they're not going to be being able to practice, or if you have to get on a track. So it was kind of putting this undue pressure when all the signs were kind of pointing to like, okay, clearly it's not going to happen. And then really like all that it takes to put on the Olympics during this global pandemic, this global crisis, we should probably be diverting those efforts and monies and focus and brain power into COVID-19 and not putting on the Olympics.
Absolutely. Let's talk about some financials of the women's sports world. The minimum salary in the NWSL is just $20,000 a year. Most players in the WNBA rely on playing overseas to pay the bills. What could a prolonged stoppage mean for athletes in your leagues? And is there a lot of concern among your teammates?
I think there is concern, yeah. As far as I know, the plan is to pay everyone through whenever this is. I think everyone's still hoping that at some point, you know, during the summer or late in the summer, that at least a portion of the season will go on. But it is quite uncertain. And obviously for the financial stability of each team and of the league, it's going to be difficult to pay all the salaries out without having, you know, really any income coming in or being able to play those games. So it is worrisome for sure.
Yeah, for us, you know, similar in that as far as this WNBA season is concerned, we don't know what's going to happen. We do have fairly regular calls with our commissioner. And, you know, there's updates, but then it's always like, that's going to probably change in 24 hours because this whole thing is changing, you know, every day. I think at the end of the day, we won't know till we know. We don't have what, you know, a lot of people have been talking about with the NBA, which is the force majeure. We don't have that in our CBA. So that kind of adds a different wrinkle for us. But more than anything, I mean, you mentioned a lot of us play overseas. That's where we make most of our money, to be honest, although the new CBA might have changed that. But mm-hmm. most of our money is made over there. And, you know, those leagues had to stop this year. So a lot of the women were home probably by early March, let's call it. And so they missed out anywhere from 2 to 2.5 months worth of salary. And then I actually worry about next year's overseas market, because I remember in 2008, 2009, when the market crashed, there were teams in Europe that folded. I do think the WNBA will figure it out. I think it'll be fine long term. I actually worry more about overseas.
You both must be speaking with other athletes about all of this. How do you help each other through all this uncertainty?
Yeah. We're like, what are you doing at home? How are you getting your workout in? Yeah, kind of seeing what everyone's doing and how everyone's keeping sane. I mean, everyone's pretty much doing the same things we are, just trying to...
A lot of memes being created.
Yeah, a lot of memes.
Not as much serious talk. I mean, I think early on, like I said, I had a lot of teammates who were overseas. So once that travel ban got put on for Europe, there was a couple of them flying back. And we were literally like, every step of the way, I was like, yeah. What's happening now? Are you in customs? What's that like? You know, like now it's kind of more into like the light and fluffy, trying to help people kind of sort of get through the day with just like I said, memes, you know, trash talk, if you will, that happens. Just, you know, and that's most of my group chatting with my teammates anyway.
Yeah.
That's great. So one more serious question before we have a little fun. I think my worry is that when sports come back, and they will come back, that everyone's going to be so excited about the return of men's pro sports that the women's games are going to be even more forgotten than they are in a normal year. So I'm wondering what we can realistically do to keep the momentum going when sports return.
I think we just need to keep out there and keep talking about it and keep putting our sport on display. I mean, it's a really... No one has ever like come to our games and left and are like, oh, that's not that exciting to watch. I mean, I think we need to have a concerted marketing effort once we get back and making sure that everyone knows when the games are, and they'll probably be a little bit more affordable than some of the other pro sports. But hopefully people will respect the fact really that we've continued to train this whole time and will come out and watch us play and support our leagues.
This time is extremely unique. And I think a lot of female athletes, similar to male athletes, but a lot of female athletes are popping up on podcasts and IG lives. And we're obviously doing our own little IG live.
Just shout out really quick to all the healthcare workers, people on the front lines, in the hospitals, supplying the hospitals, cleaning the hospitals.
And I think part of what makes men's sports successful, yes, the way they play and all that good stuff. But also, we know a lot about them. We see their personalities because, I mean, to be blunt, they're shoved in our faces, which as a fan, like, I love all sports, so I don't mind it. But now I think you are starting to see a lot of female athletes, and that can draw people in as well. So hopefully that's a nice little bonus.
Absolutely. It's been fun. I've been saying, like, now's the time. Anyone you've been wanting to talk to forever, ask for them now because they have time.
So
I want to end this conversation on a happy note. And all of us who have been asked to work from home have had some trouble adjusting to the new routine. I've had to get used to my closet here. And it sounds like you have not been entirely immune from that. I understand that you have something resembling actual exercise equipment now, but I'm hoping you can describe to me how you managed to keep working out without anything resembling real workout gear.
We had like a backpack full of water bottles at one point.
Yeah. So it was a backpack of water bottles. We weighed it on a scale. We're like, all right, we got a 20-pound dumbbell here. And then we had like a water jug we filled with water, weighed that. And I was like, all right, this is the 10-pound, quote, medicine ball we're supposed to be using. Then we ordered some stuff. So it's gotten a bit easier.
We were doing lunges in our hallway.
Yeah, the hallways become
like apartment.
We do step-ups on the coffee table, literally. Yeah, you just got to get creative. Today, though, we have to find like a steep hill. That's we got to get creative. Today, we're like looking on Google Maps. Like, I was asking my brother-in-law, I'm like, do you know of any steep hills? But you know what? The one thing I think we've learned also, you can't be too hard on yourself through this time, right? Like, all right, if I'm supposed to be doing X, Y, and Z, and it's just too hard to figure out, that's okay.
I just
do A, B, and C. Or just do X and call it a day and like be kind. Be kind to yourself.
All right, Sue and Megan, thank you so much for this. It's been great.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah,
thank you for having
us on.
That's Seattle Storm point guard Sue Bird and OL Reign forward Megan Rapinoe. And if you're wondering where you can watch their updates from home.
I've been wanting to shave my head too. And then like I did a little test today and I was like, that's a lot of forehead.
We'll have links to Sue and Megan's Instagrams at onlyagame.org. If you missed our fun conversation last week with comedian Gary Goleman, it's not too late. Subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, and you'll find all of our most recent shows. If you like what you hear, consider leaving us a 5-star review. And thanks. Scott Rudinsky sang in punk bands during his 11-year career as a major league reliever.
It's all I've ever known. I don't know anything else. This is just normal to me.
That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
Want to add more positivity to your podcast feed? Check out Kind World, stories of extraordinary kindness and compassion.
That's Kind World. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
I'm Karen Given. Just before a recent move, 52-year-old former Major League relief pitcher Scott Rudinsky was going through some junk in his garage. He found an old suitcase full of fan letters.
It was such a flashback of these kids that would reach out and write from Lehigh Valley, Pennsylvania, or somewhere in Toms River, New Jersey, places I wasn't even aware existed. And it was a lot of fun.
But these letters weren't from baseball fans. They were from music fans. And they were written over 3.5 decades ago when Rudinsky was the frontman of a hardcore punk band. Only a Game's Gary Wallach has the story.
In 1982, punk rock was booming in California. Bands like the Dead Kennedys were making national headlines. Scott Rudinsky and his junior high friends from Oxnard in Southern California were captivated.
We started going to the record store, and it was like anytime you heard another band being mentioned, you'd go check it out. Or some of the older kids might say, hey, there's a show going on at Florentine Gardens, the Dead Kennedys and TSOL. Help, help. Help me.
Scott and his friends were also influenced by so-called straight-edge hardcore bands from the East Coast, which, along with some of their followers, avoided drugs, alcohol, and tobacco. Scott and his friends started their own band.
You know, we were all skateboarders growing up in suburbia. The group came together. We developed pretty quick. Imagine 14-year-old kids, 15-year-old kids just learning how to play instruments, full of energy.
Scott and his bandmates called themselves Scared Straight. They put together shows wherever they could.
You know, vets halls and legion halls and little bars. And there was a place out by an airport, like a little hut. And it was a lot of do-it-yourself parties and gigs. And this pretty tight group of, you know, maybe 100, 150 kids.
In 1984, with Scott on lead vocals, Scared Straight was featured on a compilation LP.
This is a 14-year-old kid screaming at you. And once that record came out, it kind of went a little more national. It made you feel a little worthy.
But noise was a problem.
You know, we would rehearse in our garage at my house, and the neighbors would get super mad, and at times they would call the police. And my dad actually built this extension off my bedroom. We had a soundproof little, it was probably 10 by 10 room. It was pretty cool.
Scott's dad was a big part of his life. He'd drive the band and all their gear to shows in the family station wagon. He also coached some of the baseball teams Scott and his brother played on. Scott made his high school baseball team as a second-string first baseman. But Scott asked his coach if he could try pitching. In the final game of his sophomore season, Scott got his chance. He threw a complete 7-inning game, and his team won.
This is something I want to do. This is pretty cool. I'm going to be a pitcher.
Scott went on to become his team's ace.
Did you ever get crap from the punk rock crowd for being a serious ball player?
Oh, yeah. Gosh. I always would do my best to try to keep the music and the baseball separated. I didn't like speaking about music to the baseball people, nor did I like speaking about baseball to the music people. I don't think either side really got it.
But that same year, his dad was diagnosed with cancer. The prognosis was not good. Scott started skipping his last class to drive his dad to the doctor and later to visit him at the hospice.
To have my dad throughout my whole life being active and a part of my life, to see that and witness, you know, over the course of probably a solid year and a half, watch him just kind of go downhill was just, it was brutal.
Scott's dad died his senior year. But Scott was determined to do all the things his dad had supported. He kept singing with the band and playing baseball. And then he got a big break. In 1986, he was drafted out of high school by the Chicago White Sox. He was the 75th overall pick. Scott graduated high school on a Friday. The next day, he was in Florida for training camp.
You go from being the best in your area to now all of a sudden I'm standing with guys who pitched in college. They were just fresh out of the College World Series. And you look around and you realize, damn, man, I'm not in Simi Valley anymore.
Scott knew that if he was going to make it as a pro baseball player, it was going to be tough to keep creating music. Scott spent his first four seasons bouncing between rookie and single-A ball. During off-seasons, he connected with his old bandmates in the hope that they could write some more songs and play gigs.
For the first handful of years, the guys were going to college. They had their own jobs, and it was less frequent, but it still continued.
In 1990, Scott unexpectedly made the bigs right out of spring training. His style was aggressive and relentless, much like his singing. He was even in the mix as a long-shot AL Rookie of the Year candidate. He pitched well during the 91 and 92 seasons. Around that time,
we had a fresh batch of songs that were kind of like this new style. And somebody had said to us, well, is it a Scared Straight record? It doesn't sound like Scared Straight. We kind of sat back and reflected and said, well, yeah, you're kind of right. And we decided to change the name. We had already pressed 1,000 or 2,000 of these CDs. And when we received the first batch of CDs and cassettes, we went to Kinko's and made a little sticker, and we opened every single one of the jewel cases up, and we slapped 10-foot pole over the top of the Scared Straight, and then anywhere it said Scared Straight on the jacket, we just blacked it out with a Sharpie. It was a fresh start.
Scott would sometimes play his favorite songs on a boombox in the White Sox clubhouse. Most of his teammates were completely unfamiliar with punk music.
Oh, yeah, you play music? Oh, cool. Yeah, well, you're in a rock band? And that was kind of the extent of the conversation. I would downplay it. Yeah, we play in a rock band. And just leave it at that.
Scott could have passed for any other major league ball player, but when he worked on his songs,
it was like a different personality. And that's just the guy that comes out when I walk into the music room.
Scott's bandmates would mail him 4-track cassettes with music they'd recorded at their rehearsal space. He'd take them along when he went on the road with the White Sox, add his vocals on the spare tracks, and mail them back. Scott sometimes used the day-to-day experiences of traveling from city to city for lyrical inspiration.
There was one line in a song, I remember being on the airplane, I'm flying high above the gray, I see it on the floor beneath my feet. The song was called Fade Away.
After the 1993 season, Scott was diagnosed with Hodgkin's disease. He returned to full health following surgery and months of radiation. Scott missed the entire 1994 season. Around that same time, he left 10-foot pole.
I reached out to some friends and said, hey, do you guys want to start a band?
They named the new band Pulley. Scott got back on the mound for the 95 season while working on an album with his Pulley bandmates over the phone. Life was getting back to normal, but Scott struggled on the mound. And after the 95 season, the White Sox cut him. He hated leaving Chicago.
That was my home. I had success there. Yeah, it crushed me.
But at least he had a new band and an off season in which to finish the album and go on tour. This is it. For Scott, it was all about continuing to express himself through his songs and not about making it big in the music industry.
That was what it was all about for me, was I only have this short window of time, so I have to make this happen.
Scott signed with the Dodgers in 1996. He pitched well in L.A. for 3 seasons and then hung on for 3 more seasons in St. Louis and Cleveland. He retired from playing in 2001 with a record of 42 wins, 25 losses, and 52 saves. Not exactly Hall of Fame stats, but Scott struck out Ken Griffey Jr. 7 times in 16 at-bats. Griffey's on record as saying that Scott was the toughest lefty he ever faced.
It probably won't get any better than that, huh? You know, to hear that from one of the best hitters of my era, yeah, it's a pretty good compliment. That makes me feel pretty like I did something right.
Scott Radinsky has coached for nearly 20 years in the minors and with the big league Indians and Angels. He's more recently been involved with player development for USA Baseball and coaching high school. And he's released a total of 8 records with Pulley. So the baseball and the music continue to exist side by side.
It's all I've ever known. I don't know anything else. This is just normal to me. Give me something
to keep from burning up. Pulley had planned a tour in Europe this summer. That's on hold for now. So these days, Scott Radinsky is spending time with his family. And who could blame him if every now and then he opens up that suitcase and rereads fan letters from 3.5 decades ago.
That's Only a Game's Gary Wallach. When the NCAA canceled March Madness, you might have thought you had to wait until next year for the chance to paint your face in your college colors and trash talk to that university down the road. But never fear, because another one of our cherished Rites of Spring was thankfully recorded back in February, and it's just as much fun as it's always been.
This is the 2020 Jeopardy! College Championship.
The Ringer's Claire McNear has written all about how this annual, almost but not really sporting event can rescue us from our no sports world. Hi, Claire.
Hey.
Okay, so let's get this out of the way right away, because I know there are some people at home saying Jeopardy's not a sport. So give me your best argument for Jeopardy as sport.
All right. Well, I think a lot of casual Jeopardy viewers are surprised to learn just how sport-like the show can be. People think, okay, if you're preparing to go on Jeopardy, maybe you make a bunch of flashcards, and that definitely does happen. But, you know, it has become this very serious thing over the last few years. People compare it to, like, training to be a fighter pilot. A lot of contestants give up alcohol and caffeine in the weeks before they tape. They rearrange their meal times and eat what they think they will when they're in the studio for their tape day. They rig home buzzer systems and drill themselves over and over, trying to shave off literal hundredths or thousandths of a second from their response time. So it really is a very sport-like competition at some levels.
That's amazing. Now, some of those sports-like comparisons go away during the college tournament. The college kids probably aren't giving up every Saturday night to train with a coach, for example. On the other hand, there's quite a lot of school spirit, right?
Yeah, there absolutely is. And I think that's especially true this year. So the way the college tournament works is they bring in 15 students from 15 different schools. And, you know, there are always, you know, some Ivy League institutions in the mix. And that's the case this year as well. You've got your Princeton and your Yale. But this year, there are also a ton of schools that have well-known sporting programs, which is really fun. And it seems like producers are trying to make this as sporty as they can. This week saw students from the University of Florida and Florida State face off against a Yale student from Miami. I mean, it's a pretty unique tournament for Jeopardy, because producers really want you to choose a player and cheer them on. And maybe that's a student who happens to come from your school, or maybe that's whoever's playing your school's rival. You know, it's just like sports.
Well, so an example that's just like sports, I'd like to take you to a moment that happened this week.
All right, all right. In 2019, Matthew McConaughey became a communications professor at the University of this, his home state. Sarad.
What a sexist.
Yeah.
Okay, so Sarad is from Princeton, but another one of the contestants, Marshall, is wearing a University of Texas sweatshirt.
Exactly, and I think I'm sure that he was really hoping he would win that buzzer battle and missed out.
Can we talk for just a minute about the sweatshirts? Because I've always kind of wondered, why not t-shirts? Is it cold in that studio?
It's really cold in that studio, actually. They, out of concern for all the lights and everything, because there's just so much happening on a TV stage, they keep it at like a crypt-like chill. So honestly, like I think the hoodies are a great move. I feel terrible for contestants on normal Jeopardy who are just in like a short sleeve shirt, because they're told to dress for whatever season their episode will be airing in, which is not always the same season that they're taping in. So, you know, pro hoodie.
All right. So like March Madness, there are Cinderella stories. And I understand that this year's Cinderella story is Ole Miss.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the highlights of this tournament came on Wednesday when London Lorenz, who is a sophomore at Ole Miss, she won pretty authoritatively. And what's really remarkable about her victory is that she did it without finding any of the daily doubles or betting big in Final Jeopardy. And that's the way usually you kind of catapult yourself forward on Jeopardy. So it was really just a very impressive game. And adding to that, this is Ole Miss's very first time in the tournament. It's been going on for 30 years. This is Ole Miss's first appearance. So it's very exciting to see them advance.
I want to take just a second, though, to acknowledge her chat with Alex, because in the history of contestants saying unexpected things to Alex Trebek, I think maybe this ranks right up there.
Your majors are Arabic and International Studies, right?
Yes.
With a view to doing what?
Well, you know, I could marry a rich sheik in the Middle East, make a lot of money. That'd be fun. But right now,
I mean, there have been worse plans, probably. But I mean, part of the fun of this tournament in particular is you are seeing these college kids, and I mean, she's just a sophomore, right? So it's just so fun to see. I mean, literal teenagers in a lot of cases, just kind of have some fun.
So the clues can also be a bit more fun. Take this one from the 2018 tournament.
Wiggle, 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 yeah. Wiggle, 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 yeah.
I apologize for the low quality recording on that, but I really couldn't resist.
Yeah, I mean, so the clues in the college tournament often have something of an educational theme, not in that specific clue, but they're often a little easier than normal Jeopardy, and they're often more fun. There's usually a lot more pop culture in the college tournament. A lot of it is pretty recent stuff, and the writers love to do things like have Alex Trebek read funny lyrics, rap lyrics, and he has said that he kind of makes a point of actually not going to listen to those songs so he can kind of deliver his own authentic interpretation of lyrics like that one.
Yeah, because his interpretation is not at all like the real thing.
No, which is probably for the best.
The contestants have a lot of fun with this tournament, too. Here's a clip from 2017.
We come to Lily Chin. She had 20,400 going into final today. And her response, who is the spiciest meme lord? All right, let's see.
I don't want to say that these moments don't happen on the regular show, but there does seem to be something a little looser, a little more fun about the college tournament, right?
There absolutely is. And that's what makes it so special. I mean, in addition to Jeopardy kind of encouraging you to root along, like it is just authentically really fun. And they're obviously really, really bright students, but it's just great to kind of watch them have a sense of humor about it. And Lily Chin has actually said that in the years since her tournament, she's still approached by people about the spiciest meme lord. People will see her on the street and just shout spiciest meme lord at her.
Okay, so there's one more week of the tournament still to come. Make your best argument for why it should be the sport we all tune into next week.
Well, first of all, there's not a lot of competition going on right now on the sporting front. But it is a really serious competition, and it's a new competition, you know. You turn on ESPN and you're watching old World Series games or old NBA Finals games. But here we don't really know what'll happen, even though it did tape a couple months ago. And it's just really fun to watch people who are really good at something do that thing. And I think everybody should tune in next week.
Claire McNear is a staff writer for The Ringer. Claire, is it too soon to mention that you're writing a book about Jeopardy?
Not at all too soon. I'm writing a book about Jeopardy, and that'll be out in November.
Thanks, Claire.
Thank you so much.
On what was supposed to be baseball's opening day, a friend suggested that Red Sox organist Josh Cantor play music on a live stream.
And I thought, that sounds like fun. I was like, how do you do a live stream? He said, I don't know, just look on Google.
That's coming up. And remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at OnlyAGameNPR.
Need to escape the news for a moment?
Check out Endless Thread, a podcast from WBUR and Reddit.
From mysteries to histories to stories that will remind you of our shared humanity.
Subscribe to Endless Thread on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, we go inside NASCAR's iRacing series, which turns out to be a pretty satisfying substitute for the real thing. But now it's time for Charlie Pierce and the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Karen.
There's been a lot of talk this week about how and when to bring back sports. Let's start with Major League Baseball. According to reports, the league is considering returning to training camps in May and starting play soon thereafter. Here's the catch. All the players and all the personnel for all the teams would be sequestered in Arizona in what's being called a bubble league. What do you make of this idea?
I think it's bubble-headed. You know, how are the players going to feel about, you know, essentially being away from their families and, you know, living in a hotel or whatever? You know, I'm sure it'll be a very nice hotel, but this is just crazy. You know, it's good to think outside the box, but sometimes you really do have to come back into the box.
Other leagues are also looking into options to restart, though none might be as committed to the idea as UFC President Dana White. He had secured a location in the U.S. to host UFC 249 on April 18th and was working on securing an undisclosed private island for future international fights. But all fights are off after White received a call from, quote, the highest level you can go at Disney. So at least someone's thinking clearly.
Yeah, congratulate Mickey. He's the highest level at Disney, isn't he?
I think so.
Yeah, Mickey decided that this wasn't going to happen. I am intrigued by the private island idea, though.
Well, White seems to think that this is some sort of public service. He told ESPN, quote, "You keep people in their houses for too long without entertainment. People are going to start losing their minds, and we need to start figuring out solutions." I mean, on the one hand, we do need something to watch once we've all streamed Tiger King, but I'm not sure the UFC is the right choice.
Yeah, I mean, and by the way, isn't his primary audience people who have lost their minds?
Meanwhile, Oklahoma State head football coach Mike Gundy told reporters that he'd like his team to start resuming normal operations by May 1st. He said his players are young and healthy and that they should be able to fight off the virus. Not surprisingly, Oklahoma State followed that teleconference with a statement saying that the university would decide when to return, not the coach. Good move.
Oh, I think, you know, reasserting the primacy of the university over the university's football program. Yeah. Noted epidemiologist Mike Gundy should shut up. Okay, first of all, he doesn't know what he's talking about. Second of all, he is a $5 million government employee, and the government of Oklahoma says no. So that's the end of it.
The NFL draft will be virtual, Charlie, but that doesn't mean we'll have to do without seeing Commissioner Roger Goodell greet the newest members of his league. EA Sports is apparently working up virtual interactions between Goodell and likely first-round draftees. Players are given the choice of how they'd like to interact. Bear hug and jumping shoulder bump are among the options. I don't know. Is this enough to make you want to tune into the draft?
That might be, actually, because I'd be interested to, like, develop the percentages on who goes for the hug and who goes for the jumping chest bump or whatever. And, you know, as far as I know, Roger Goodell has been a virtual commissioner for years.
NBA fans have not been entirely deprived of watching their favorites at work as the NBA 2K Players Tournament winds its way to a conclusion this weekend. Sadly, those hoping to bet on the tournament, for entertainment purposes only, of course, were stymied when the results of the first round were leaked and betting had to be suspended. And this is why we can't have nice things.
I don't understand why they didn't do this live.
Right.
Which would have, you know, solved this whole problem. Of course the results leaked. You're talking about gamblers. You're talking about people who live their lives looking for an edge.
Yeah.
Although I think, you know, it's really rather pathetic if, you know, your big gambling score is past posting on a video game.
Meanwhile, NASCAR driver Bubba Wallace discovered this week that virtual racing can have actual consequences. When he lost a sponsor for rage quitting last Sunday's iRacing Pro Invitational, Blue Emu executive VP Ben Blessing said the company severed ties with Bubba because, quote, "You find out that you aren't sponsoring a NASCAR driver. You are sponsoring someone like my 13-year-old son who broke his controller playing some game where he builds houses."
Oh, well, yeah, I don't go to auto racing because, you know, people who go to auto racing only want to see controllers crash.
And finally, Charlie, there's been one positive to putting the sports calendar on hold. Alabama football coach Nick Saban, a notorious technophobe, has finally entered the 1990s.
You know, I can actually get an email now and read what somebody, I mean, it's like, I've really come a long way.
I have no idea how anybody gets along without email. That to me is astonishing. Much less a guy who's probably got God knows how much technical equipment in his office.
Right.
I mean, is he still calling, you know, Mabel the operator to place a call to recruits?
He might just be. Charlie Pierce is the guest editor of the Best American Sports Writing 2019, and he joins us each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you, Karen.
If you're like me, you're missing baseball. Not so much baseball on TV. I'll admit, I've never been a huge fan of that. But I love going to the ballpark. I love sitting in the two small seats at Fenway. Josh Cantor loves it there, too. And since 2003, he's had his own special seat at the keys of Fenway Park's organ. During the games, Josh takes requests via Twitter from fans in the stadium, and it becomes sort of a game within a game to listen to whether Josh will be able to make those requests happen. This spring, Josh has been missing baseball, so along with his wife, Mary Eaton, he decided to do something about it. I talked to him earlier this week.
My old friend Jason, whom I've known for almost 30 years, he texted me on the afternoon of what would have been the opening day of the baseball season. And he said, you should do a live stream and play some songs today. And I thought, that sounds like fun. I was like, how do you do a live stream? He said, I don't know, just look on Google. So I watched a video, a little 4-minute tutorial. And then my wife, Mary, helped me set it up.
Hello. Welcome to, are we going here? I'm not sure.
Not yet, I don't think so.
We didn't really know what we were doing as far as how to get good sound, how to get good picture, how to talk.
I am here and just thought anybody who wanted to say hello, say hello. I'll play a song. Maybe I'll play like Take Me Out to the Ball Game. It'd be a nice little seventh inning stretch.
And we thought it was going to be a one-time thing. It would last a few minutes. A couple people might show up.
That said, I can't tell if anybody is here right now. Is there a way?
11 people.
There's 11 people. Holy free holies. Let's wait like one more minute, and then and I'll stall with my really super interesting banter.
It turned out that a ton of people showed up, and we got almost 100 song requests, and I had time to get to about 40 of them, and after over an hour, we finally decided, okay, we have to be done now.
You're the best, and this is an old Tin Pan Alley song called All of Me, and then we'll sign out.
As soon as we finished, we both realized how much we enjoyed that and how much we needed it. And so we committed to doing it for a half hour every afternoon, 3 o'clock Eastern time.
It's time for the seventh inning stretch. That's the name of the show. And part of it is every day we do a stretch. We sing Take Me Out to the Ball Game. You have earned this stretch. Have a moment of joy in your day.
It just feels lovely to have that community and that kindness and that respite and, you know, just a little bit of joy. And we're not burying our heads in the sand, but it's an activity, an exercise that refortifies us so that we can face those stresses and those challenges.
How was your day, Reverend Producer Mary? We haven't even really seen each other today because you've been busy reverending.
Oh man, I got the greatest job in the whole world! Like
producing this show, you mean?
My wife Mary is a minister and she works primarily with the homeless population in Boston, so that's been particularly stressful right now. It's a community that is particularly vulnerable, and hunger has become a big issue. And so we decided right from the get-go that we would ask people who are enjoying the show and who have the means to make a donation to their local food bank.
And Ken Z says, donated to my local food bank today in honor of Al Kaline, a Charm City native. Thank you so much, Kenzie. And that reminds me...
It's just been another warm way in which we're seeing people come together and help each other.
Good Lord, these requests are coming in fast and furious. Mary's going to help me try to keep track of them.
It occurs to me that people also get to see something that they don't get to see from your perch in Fenway Park, which is when you're playing in Fenway Park, we all send you requests and you figure them out while the baseball is going on and you play them for us. But now we're seeing the requests come in real time and we're seeing you figure out how to play the songs in real time.
Mm-hmm. See, now I gotta get it right. I can't mess this one up.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a, you know, a peek behind the curtain, I guess you could say. Sometimes I'll do a little practice run of a song, just a rough draft, you know, 10, 15 seconds of it to make sure I remember it.
Oh, I really want to be able to do this one. Concentrate, Josh.
It never felt like a luxury until now, but at the ball games I have, you know, maybe 2 minutes from the time the request comes in until I have to learn the song and play it. That always felt like I was extremely pressed for time. Now I have no, you know, now I have maybe 10 seconds. Some people have mentioned to me that they've enjoyed getting that little behind the scenes peek at how it works, because it is sort of strange how it works.
It's strange and somehow magical, I gotta say.
Thank you.
Do you find that you're missing baseball any less since you've started doing this?
It's these sort of compensations. You know, it's like two ends of a scale. So on one end of the scale, I'm missing baseball so much, and I'm missing playing music with friends so much, and I'm missing seeing friends, and I'm missing just being at the ballpark. And then on the other end of the scale are the things that I'm doing to try to offset that a bit, such as doing this show every day, such as interacting with people on the internet, such as making a point of checking in more frequently with family and friends to see how everybody's doing. So I guess I'm still missing it a lot, but I'm finding other ways to offset that a bit.
Bo says he's been looking forward to this all day. You and me both, Bo. You and me both.
People have, you know, reached out to me and written me messages from all over the world talking about, you know, why it means something to them. And I kind of feel like, not so much like a therapist, but I feel like people's bartender, you know. Sometimes people come up to the bar and they feel like they can open up to the bartender about what's on their mind.
Adam says, I got him weepy. Sorry about that, Adam. Can't help it. I think we're all feeling a little weepy right now. And then all you have to do is like throw in a lush melody and the tears just flow. You know what I'm saying?
I've been, you know, trying to respond as much as I can and as best as I can to offer the encouragement and support that I am able to give. We all need each other right now, and the more we commit to helping each other all get through it together, the better off we're going to be and the less scarred we're going to be when we get to the other side.
Josh, thanks so much. I know you're busy. I really appreciate it.
I'm always happy to talk to you, Darren.
Be good to yourself. Be good to each other. Wash your hands. Help where you can. We love you.
We love you.
Josh Cantor and his wife, Mary Eaton, stream the seventh inning stretch on Facebook Live at 3 p.m. Eastern every single day. If you tune in, don't be surprised if you see me in the chat. I particularly enjoy requesting songs from old Charlie Brown specials. Only a Game is produced by Jonathan Chang, Martin Kessler, and Gary Wallach. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is me. I'm Karen Gibbon. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.